Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and PT pearls to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in.
Welcoming in our next guest, Cara Lowenthal. She's a master certified coach, and after getting her bachelor's at Yale and then a law degree at Harvard Law, she really amounted an amazing resume in the law field, both in the court and also in academics. And then she pivoted into this career of coaching. And I just need to warn you, there's going to be some explicit language because she is the host of a popular iTunes podcast called Unfuck Your Brain. So we dive in a little bit to what that means. How to retrain your mindset, how to retrain the messages you tell yourself about your circumstances, about your ability, about your money, about your body and self-image. So really stay tuned as we dive in.
Cara, thank you so much for being here and agreeing to be on our podcast. I think this is going to be a really interesting conversation that I'm excited for people to be a part of and just kind of be a fly on the wall for. And I just want to start, we kind of like to dive right into like, what is your overarching purpose for being here that you feel like you're really bringing people?
Yeah, but here, do we mean on the podcast or like on this earth?
On this earth.
They're probably the same, but yeah. I really feel like my mission in life is to teach women how to liberate themselves from the inside out. I spent a lot of time before I became a coach helping to try to kind of produce social liberation and freedom and equality and autonomy for women through policy and legal work. And now I feel like my mission is really to teach women how to do the work of freedom and self-acceptance and empowerment from the inside, because it just became clear to me that if we don't change the way that we think and the way that society has impacted our minds, then it's really not going to matter what kind of external changes we make.
I think that's an amazing place to start. And I really love, we love talking to people's why, right, at the beginning of the show and just understanding where that is and where their values are, and then kind of digging into where that passion comes from. And, you know, I look at kind of what I call your rap sheet or your resume, and you went to Yale, you went to Harvard, your resume is incredible. You have all these what people would look at and say like, oh my gosh, these are incredible successes. But then what I see, what you're so passionate in, I look at all of these quote successes and say, hey, that probably has driven some of what you're so passionate about. Because I mean, in a different, much different way, I played college football. And just to be vulnerable about myself a little bit, a lot of my anxieties and a lot of the things I find myself comparing in and how my body looks and what my body can do comes from my history of being in college athletics. I spent every day with these men and literally saw every part of them. And so it's hard to not start your comparing yourself in a lot of ways. So I want to kind of ask in a long way, how does that history that you have play into what you're so passionate about now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the whole reason that I sort of became awake to the importance of the mental aspect of it is that I was doing all those things that should, according to the conventional world, make me feel great, right? Like I went to those schools, and then even within those schools, after I went to law school, I got an appellate court clerkship, which is a very kind of competitive thing to get, a federal appeals court clerkship. And then I got the one fellowship in my whole field that was open when I graduated. Mm. And then I went into academia and I got fellowships at Yale and Columbia. Like it's like, would be hard to have more academic or professional achievement really in that field. But I never felt any more confident, and I still felt insecure and I still felt anxious. And so I was kind of living this life that supposedly should have felt great, and it really didn't. And I think I had always been interested in psychology and coaching and yoga and meditation, like all the different ways that I think we just all try to like get through this human life a little more smoothly. But I do think that like my own experience really brought home to me that, you know, you can like admit women into the top schools, and you know you can get the top jobs and you can do all those things, they still don't create confidence for you if that's not the way you're thinking about yourself. And then once I started kind of digging into the work, it became clear to me that was just true in every area of your life. But I think my professional life is where it became the most obvious, because I was ticking off. You know, with body stuff, it would have been, it was easier to think like, oh, well, that's because I don't have that perfect body yet, or because I don't, you know, have that perfect partner yet in the room, whatever it is. But in professional stuff, it really was like, okay, I mean, I guess I could believe it's like because I went to Harvard, but I didn't graduate in the top 10% of my class. But like, we're starting to strain credulity that like that would really make the difference and change how I feel.
Do you feel a lot of people that were going to school with you and kind of on the same path suffered a lot from comparison, perfectionism, anxiety? Like, do you think that it was all in all kind of
a yes theme? To all of that, 100%, and any other word you would add, they're all the same.
So how did you even start to become aware that that is what you were dealing with? Because I think when you, again, this is your environment, that's what you're surrounded by. How do you know what it's, you know, how do you know how to even address it? Where do you start?
Yeah, well, I think in a weird way, law school made it easier to see this, because if you are paying attention to your own mind and your own field, like, law school teaches you to think, you know, when I started my coaching business, I actually only worked with lawyers, women lawyers, and I have a whole, like, a theory and body of work about what law school does to your brain, which maybe I'll resuscitate someday, but law school basically teaches you to think in ways that are characteristic of people who are ranging from pessimistic to have depression, like to always worry about the worst case scenario, to treat every interaction like it's kind of adversarial and somebody has to win, to obsess about small details that don't matter, and to always look for what might go wrong or where somebody might be lying to you. Like, you come into law school and you're probably already a little anxious and risk averse, and that's why you chose law school. And then it gets so much worse because they're basically changing your brain without really letting you know that that's what's happening and without giving you any tools to deal with it. So I think just sort of watching my own mind and watching my own experience through law school was part of that. I also think it helped. I mean, there was a way in which when I got, especially to Harvard, I sort of looked around and I was like, oh man, I'm just not willing to do what's going to be required to like be at the top of this class. Like, that kind of, it didn't solve my perfectionism, but you just, like, the more I was in a smaller and smaller group of like the most, you know, yes, smart, but also just like deranged workaholic people in the world, the like less it seemed like a plausible good way to live my life. But I do, you know, it really wasn't until I went to a lot of therapy, I worked with different kinds of coaches, I was into yoga, I was into meditation, like all the things. It really wasn't until I found my teacher, Brooke Castillo, whose school is called the Life Coach School. And just like, you know, I'm sure you guys have experienced this too. Like, I'm sure she was not the first person to say to me at age like 35 that your thoughts cause your feelings, you can change how you think. But that was like the first time I was ready to hear it. And so it's not like I saw the whole scope of the problem and then set out to find a solution. I just was aware that I was stressed out and unhappy. And also I thought, I mean, this is the other thing, right? A lot of perfectionists come to self-development work actually because they're like, oh, this is something I can use to fix myself and get better so I can finally feel good about myself. Yeah. And like, I did that too. But then if you stick with it, you start to see like, oh, maybe the whole problem is not that like I need to fix myself, but it's the idea that there's something wrong with me that I need to fix. That's really my problem.
Oh, that's a good one-liner to end that thought on, because we truly are a product of that environment that we spend so much time in. And like you said, you know, being a lawyer and living at that fast pace, you're in this environment for so long and you can know something's wrong. You can even be aware of it. You can go to a self-development class for 2 or 3 days and think you learned some tools to be able to buffer that. Again, the meditation stuff, the whatever it is. But until you commit to it long-term and actually retrain, like you, I think a term you use is kind of retrain that brain or unfuck your brain, which is the name of your podcast, which I love. What do you mean by retraining that brain? And once people are aware and they want to like commit to it, kind of dive into that a little more.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I, like most people, just kind of assumed that my thoughts were true. That's why I was thinking them. And definitely just kind of thought like, it's like you wake up when you're born and somebody gives you a suitcase and you're like, all right, I guess this is all I can ever wear. Like, that's what's in here. Like, that's how I think I thought about my thoughts. If I thought about them at all, it was just like, I think them because they're true and there's really nothing I can do about them. And so I think for me, it was revelatory to realize, like, number one, this is what I teach other people now. Like, number one, you have no idea what you're actually thinking. you have so many subconscious thoughts every day that you're not paying attention to and you're not kind of aware of. And sometimes subconscious is a confusing term, but it's really just like your brain is always doing something, and sometimes you're paying attention to what it's saying and sometimes you're not. And so you have all these thoughts that you don't even know about. Most of my clients are kind of shocked to discover how self-critical their thinking is when they really pay attention to it and get it down on paper. And then I think the secret to life is that it turns out you don't just have to believe whatever your brain says to you. You don't just have to operate your life based on whatever gobbledygook it like has come up with for you, which is not always accurate or useful or true. You can actually decide what to think on purpose and just practice thinking it. And if you do that long enough, you will believe it, and then it will just become a default automatic thought. So the idea that you can choose what to think and that your thoughts are what create everything else in your life because they create your feelings, like your feelings are caused by your thoughts, and then the way you act is caused by your feelings. So everything is like flowing from those thoughts. When you learn how to identify them and change them, that's what unfucking or retraining or whatever you want to call it. It's basically using the neuroplasticity of your brain, which is your brain's ability to learn new things and to change on purpose, to actually think different thoughts so that you can create different results in your life.
That is so massive and so huge. And I think it's such a hard process that people don't realize up front and don't even realize how much we allow those feelings, well, this is how I'm feeling, so this is what's true, to really guide the way that we behave and act and hold ourselves back, right? And it's like, as physical therapists, we're working with this a lot, retraining the brain in terms of how your pain experience is happening within the body and what you've made up about your body based on, you know, it goes down the gamut that way as well. But I think a lot of people, you know, it gets so held back. And one of the practices we use to just at least start and guide people in, we talk about this breathwork thing on the podcast a lot. And are there any practices or processes that you kind of guide people into that you say, this is a great place to at least start to identify? Like what are some practical tools that people can use right now to just start to, like, either whether it's identifying it, whether it's diving in, whether it's becoming aware, like what are some of the processes that you use?
Yeah, I mean, I think the two most basic things you can do is, number one, to become aware of your thoughts, you need to write them down. Mm-hmm. Just like trying to think them and pay attention to them is like the next level, unless you're a very experienced meditator. I find it's much more helpful to just write them down and get them all out on paper. And then what I teach in terms of changing thoughts is, a lot of people who are, you know, I mean, I think I do get some people come find the podcast who've like never even heard of life coaching or self-development or anything else. But a lot of people have some awareness of it, but what they've heard about changing thoughts is mostly like affirmations or like positive thinking or like high vibrations or whatever other kind of nonsense. And so I think that one of the reasons people give up on trying to change their thoughts is that they're being, and this is like a perfect example for physical therapy, like they're being totally unrealistic, right? Like if somebody came into you guys and was like, okay, so like, here's the problem. I have this, you know, whatever, this injury that didn't heal well, and there's scar tissue and my mobility is restricted. And what I want to have happen is you just show me how it would look to do it the right, to like move perfectly. And then I'll just be able to do that the next day, because I like saw it once.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? You'd be like, that's not how the brain or the body works. Right? And we all think that would be silly. Like if somebody was like, oh, I think I'd like to deadlift 500 pounds. I've never done anything. Let's like start with that. We all know that that wouldn't work. You have to build up and condition your strength. Your brain is the same way. So I teach a technique called the thought ladder, which, and I have a whole episode of my podcast about it for people who want more, but you basically, like if your thought about your body is an example I use all the time, is my stomach is disgusting, which is a thought a lot of women have about their stomach unconsciously or consciously. Trying to believe my body is beautiful is just way too big of a leap. That's like trying to deadlift the 500 pounds with no training. It's not going to work. So you're going to try. You're not going to feel anything. And then you're going to be like, I can't even do this right, or even that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It must be true that my stomach is disgusting. And so instead, we try to take a tiny step up the ladder and look for a neutral thought, which is a thought that just feels a little bit better or not quite as terrible. And so that might be something like, this is a human stomach, or lots of people have stomachs that look like this. I always say, like, your neutral thought should be, it should not be inspirational enough to be on like a Pinterest graphic. Like, it should not, it would not look good on a picture of the sunset posted in Aruba. It should, but it will, it's something you can believe, and it will start to change the way you're thinking if you practice it. So write down all your thoughts, pick a thought that's really bothering you and, you know, fucking up your life or your brain, a thought that causes a lot of pain for you, and then pick like a tiny baby step up from that thought rather than trying to jump to believing the opposite.
I think that's a great kind of what I would call anchor behavior for people to dive into. And so many valuable things right there that, like for journaling, how you said, just write down all those thoughts you normally have. And some people will say, okay, you can stop there. Or some people will say, now write the affirmation. That's the, you know, amazing positive version of that. Again, you go one step deeper. Like, you can't always just start there. You got to even maybe go to, what can we say instead of those negative things, which we'll tell people about food all the time. It's hard when you start making good and bad foods, because then you start attaching this negativity to every time you have ice cream. And if I did that for myself, that would be an awful life, because then I'd be feeling guilty once a week when I run and get some ice cream or something like that.
The ice cream is delicious.
Yeah, I know, because ice cream is awesome.
Right. And you have to kind of like earn the, I think, you know, you'll see people who are more advanced and like they can just pick an amazing affirmation, but it's just like somebody who's in incredible physical shape from, you know, working out all the time. Yeah, they do pick up like a new physical activity more quickly, but they've sort of earned that ability with the painstaking work. And the same is true. Like, yeah, one day you will be able to just come up with an amazing thought and believe it immediately if you build that skill. But you got to earn that. You don't get that on day one. You have to build up the skill. It's literally a skill you have to learn.
So if someone is writing this down and then, you know, kind of going to that neutral thought, do they just kind of identify that neutral thought process and stay there? Do you recommend that they write it daily? Like, how often?
Practice it all the time, however you want. You can put it on a post-it note. Yeah, more than once a day. I mean, it depends on how big of a deal the thought is, but usually people are starting with like thoughts that are really, you know, they're thinking them all the time. So yeah, you can set a timer to remind you on your phone. There's a couple of different apps that will, you can program ahead of time to like alert you with the thought. I have students who will like sing it to themselves. There are some studies showing that singing something makes you learn it like a lot, like 10 or 20 times faster or something. Mm-hmm. Than repeating it to yourself without singing. So some people will like make a little tune. You can make it your password for your computer, put post-its on the house, write it on your mirror and lipstick if you want, like whatever you can do. But literally it's just saying it to yourself in your mind. That's what thinking is. It's just saying a thought inside your brain, or you can say it out loud if you want, if there's no one else around or you don't care what they think. But literally just practicing it. Yeah, it just takes practice and repetition. And then what you'll find is eventually it becomes, now you just believe it, and it's like not as, you know, you don't have to remember to think it. You're not having the old thought anymore. That just is like your default thought that you believe. And then you can move up another rung. Mm. And, you know, eventually I think you don't have to go like baby step by baby step forever once you've done this a bit. I mean, here's the thing about learning how to think differently. Like, it is, because it's a skill, it's something that your brain can actually learn how to do. And when your brain, so like take driving, when you learn how to drive in the beginning, it's like terrifying and you have to think about it a lot and you feel like you can't keep all the moving parts in your head and right, it takes a lot of effort, you get into accidents and it's all like a big mess. And then eventually you learn to drive so well that it moves from the conscious to the subconscious to the kind of autonomous portion of your brain, and then your brain can execute that skill without you even really paying close attention. That's why you can have a conversation with someone else. If you're not paying attention, sometimes you'll like drive to your old house because it was just on autopilot.
Yeah.
And so learning to think new thoughts is actually a skill that can then become automatic. Your brain will, it's like your brain will start coaching itself if you practice.
I think that's a really cool process to start talking about, because that's when we start putting science and actual like behavior learning to these practices of affirmations and manifestation. And again, like all the fluffy things that people put out there that is actually really hard and a lot of work, because it's a behavior. And I think when I was getting into school, I was so frustrated because in the medical field, we just throw things at the symptoms, get those to go away up front, let people run home for 6 more months until they come back worse, but we're just throwing band-aids on it. And a lot of people think that the language or the affirmation is just going to create the thing, but in reality, it just allows you to be a little more open to the opportunities that are always out there. And then you might just take that opportunity, therefore begetting a behavior. And then the behavior might make you feel a little bit better and say the thing a little bit more and then be a little more open. And like you said, then you just have this more openness in your system to all those opportunities that you know are out there that are awesome.
Yeah, I think the way I would say it is that I think that manifestation works because of the model behind it, which is when you think a certain way, you will feel a certain way. Mm-hmm. When you feel a certain way, you will act a certain way. So this is the like thought, emotion, behavior from cognitive behavioral therapy, and people in personal development might call it something else. But it's like the basic idea is if you believe, like if you truly believe, you've practiced believing, like earned the belief that you are amazing at making money, you are going to feel confident, excited, abundant, whatever feeling you're going to have. And then you're going to act completely differently from someone who believes they're terrible at making money. Like you said, you're going to see a bunch of different opportunities. You're going to come up with creative ideas. Like, I mean, the thing that people really, I think, don't totally appreciate is that the human brain is the most creative, powerful thing in the world. It's like you have like a supercomputer inside your head, and most of us are not using it on purpose. And most of us are not giving it instructions that make our lives better. In fact, we're often giving it programs to run that make our lives worse. Mm. And so, yeah, anything like kind of manifesting or attracting or whatever, like I don't believe that the universe cares one way or the other about it. I think that when you are thinking a certain way and you believe it, you will feel a certain way, you will act a certain way, and you will create that thing for yourself. But what a lot of people jump over is the part where you have to actually believe it. And if you don't teach people how to know when they actually believe something, then you get a bunch of people who are practicing empty thoughts they don't believe, that are going too far and they don't believe them. Then they don't get a different feeling. They don't act any differently. They don't get a different result. And then they're like, you know, like positive thinking is bullshit. Changing your thoughts doesn't work. All my thoughts are true, right? It's so important to understand how to know if you believe something or not, and then how to adjust and calibrate so that you can work on believing it more.
100%. I mean, and this, like we've said with so many other things, it takes practice, it takes work, and it takes trying it on. Like, and this will be uncomfortable at first. I think leaning into this discomfort and understanding and knowing that, but being willing to try it on. And I hope that people really, like, you know, take that in and okay, let me explore. Let me just try this ladder and see if I can get to a neutral thought. Let me see what that feels like and do it for a little while. And I hope that really people start to develop that practice, you know. Now, where would you say was your biggest struggle when you were starting this work? Like, did you have something that you were kind of butting up against? Like, no matter what you did, it was super hard to dive in. It was hard to get past a level. Like, did you have anything like that?
Well, I mean, I think I felt like all parts of my life were like, I was mad about all. I didn't, like, I was, you know, felt bad about all of them. The thing that I did the work on the most at first was body image and body acceptance. And that one was really a, like, through the looking glass. Like, I think I have a podcast episode where I talk about this, but when I discovered this work, I already I was already a feminist. I already believed that. I already sort of felt like I understood and believed that, you know, I hadn't really fleshed out the ways in which growing up in a kind of male-dominated society impacts a woman's brain. Like, I hadn't applied this work to it, but I definitely sort of already had a set of beliefs about, you know, women's equality and empowerment. And I felt like I wasn't quite living up to them. And there was this disconnect, but I was like aware of them. When I started body image work, I was just 100% like captured by, like intellectually captured by the society. Like I just totally believed that thin was better. Thin was attractive. You weren't lovable unless you were thin. You weren't good enough unless you were thin. That being fat was, you know, disgusting and bad and evidence of like not, you know, like any negative association, basically. And so that was like, I think doing the work on that was the most mind-blowing, because it was a place where I was like, had completely I just had such blinders on. It wasn't like I already knew there was a disconnect between what I believed and how I felt, or, you know, I just was sort of like completely in the ideology. And then when I started doing this work on it, I mean, I actually ironically learned thought work in the way that I teach it now from my teacher in a weight loss program. It was like the last thing I ever did to try to quote unquote lose, to like try to lose weight before I found body acceptance and fat acceptance and health at any size and body positivity and all of the like assorted movements. So it was like quite the irony. It was like I discovered that, and then she was teaching weight loss and the thought work to like lose weight. But then once I started doing the thought work, I was like, well, wait a minute. Like, if accepting my and loving myself and feeling good about my body has to happen to my mind, it won't happen even magically. If I did magically weigh 110 pounds or whatever it was, I'm still not going to feel good about myself if I don't change my thinking. Mm-hmm. But if I change my thinking, then why do I need to change my body? And like that question unlocked everything for me.
Thanks for diving into that a little bit and sharing a bit of your own journey with that. And I think that this is a super important thing and something that we definitely want to dive more into, because it's in front of us every day. I mean, every time you go on social media, every time you go on any media, I mean, that body image comparison game starts immediately. And it's really hard to not allow ourselves to go there and not allow our minds to go there. I really like everything you just shared. And you mentioned something like health at every size. I think that's a very important phrase that just kind of jumped out at me, because there are ways to be very healthy individuals no matter what you look like. And I'm wondering if you can dissect a little more into where people can start with that if they find themselves opening up their social media and becoming anxious because they don't look a certain way, or because they're finding themselves in that comparison game and can't get into that self-love. I know that's a big buzz phrase, is self-love. How do we get into that?
But I think the way that you said that even is like the way we try to deal with thoughts that we are afraid of or feelings we don't like is we try to like stop them from happening. Mm. And that is not effective. Yeah. So like you can't go on Instagram and be like, okay, brain, just don't think any mean thoughts about me. It's like not how your brain works. And now you've told your brain to be on the lookout for any mean thoughts. So it's just going to become like hyper vigilant about them. So I think it's the opposite. We have to really, I mean, what I love so much about this work is that when you are willing to learn how to go into a negative emotion to find out what are the thoughts causing it, how can I change them, then you don't have to be afraid of a negative emotion coming up. I mean, we haven't talked about it so far, but one of the first things I teach people when they start working with me is like somatic ways to process an emotion. Because what most of us think an emotion feels like is actually what it feels like when you resist an emotion, freak out about an emotion, try to distract or get rid of an emotion, and then make it 30 times worse because you're doing that. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you know, if you're going to open Instagram and you're going to have a bunch of inspiration in your feed, you are going to feel shitty about yourself. And so you have to be willing to let that come up so that you can actually dig into it, because any jealousy or envy or insecurity you feel is just a like bright flashing neon arrow to a set of thoughts that you need to look at and decide if you want to keep believing. Mm. So I think you have to lean into it. I also think with visual media specifically, you know, I usually don't teach that we should like change our circumstance, because I think, you know, our reaction to our circumstances is what allows us to get to know what we're thinking. And you can't just hide from all the things in the world that might bother you. But I will say visual stimuli is so, we're bombarded with images of unrealistic bodies in our society. And I don't think you need to like go add to it just to bring stuff up for yourself. And I, you know, the studies show that one of the best ways to make you hate your body is to look at like a women's magazine for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So, and now that's Instagram. So I do generally recommend, like, if you're working on body acceptance or anything, like if you have thoughts about wrinkles or gray hair or having a larger nose or being curvy or being really skinny or whatever it is, that you try to curate your visual feed, especially on something like Instagram, with bodies that look more like yours. You'll still get plenty of opportunities to do some thought work on how you feel when you see other bodies, but you can actually reset your brain's baseline. So it's still wild to me that like when I used to see, you know, women who are a size 2 or fashion models or whatever, I thought that that's what was beautiful and that's what I should look like. And now I have done enough of this work, both changing my thoughts one by one, but also just changing what I look at visually on a daily basis, so that now that looks strange to me. Mm. Like, genuinely, what looks normal to me is a size, is a woman who's like, and I don't mean, by normal, I just mean sort of like average, like doesn't even register in my brain. Like, is a woman who is, you know, I don't know, between sizes 12 and 20 or whatever. I'm not trying to like get really specific about it, but that's just now my visual norm, is people who look more like me. And so now when I see someone who's extremely thin that I in the past would have thought like, my life would be amazing if I just looked like that, it actually stands out to me as like looking strange. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that body type or anything actually strange about it, but since I don't live in that body, there is really no benefit to me of making that seem like the way a body should look to myself.
Yeah, that's so interesting. How do you approach health at any body weight? So we want to always stick with, how are we approaching the mindset? How are we approaching? I think that should be baseline anywhere. Now, how do you go into saying, okay, what does health look like for me?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's two elements to it. One of which is, of course, there are, you know, some of the things that impact our health are under our control, but a lot of them are not, which is like a very unpopular opinion in the wellness world. But there's genetics, there's epigenetics, there's trauma, there's food deserts, there's chronic stress from being, you know, in a marginalized population. There's pollution if you live in a poor neighborhood that is near a factory. There's like so many things that impact our health, only some of which we actually can control. And so part of it is not acting like health, like just like you were saying, health is not one thing. The same kind of health is not available to everyone. And I think we do people such a disservice when we pretend that if you just even manage your mind perfectly, or like buy these supplements, or have the exact right workout regime, that like you, everybody can have the same experience of health. And health is not a moral issue. We have really moralized it in our society. And that's not just us. I mean, there's a long tradition of like people equating kind of illness or quote unquote deformity or whatever with sin. So there's like a real Christian tradition behind this. But your health doesn't mean anything about you as a person, but we have really made it something that has to do with your moral status or your worth. So it's like there's a lot of work there to do on the baseline. And then the next level of the work is actually educating yourself about what actually impacts your health, which is not weight, is right. I mean, if you look at the studies, having a quote unquote overweight BMI is actually more protective against death than having a quote unquote normal weight BMI. And having an underweight BMI is actually the most higher risk of death than from having a normal or overweight BMI. So there's a lot of science, like what you see in the media or from mainstream doctors who got half an hour of nutrition science in medical school 20 years ago is not actually accurate. So it's like, if you really want to dig into it, you got to learn about metabolic syndrome and the science of insulin and insulin resistance and understand like what part of that is controllable by choices and what part isn't and is genetic or genetic predisposition. And then, you know, what actually impacts your health and what doesn't, because there's plenty of like size 2 girls eating a burger and fries on Instagram and getting a million comments about how cute and adorable they are. And then if a fat person does it, it's like disgusting and promoting obesity, right? So we don't really, most people have no idea what the actual science is behind weight, health, metabolic syndrome, the things that actually impact your health and the things that don't.
Exactly. And I think that's important to continue to dive into. I mean, I remember even just talking with a girlfriend not too long ago, and she said, oh, like we found out our house has so much mold in it and we're moving. And my immediate thought was, what a privilege. What a privilege to even know that you are in a house surrounded by mold, that you are able to get that test and that you're able to move. A lot of people would not be able to do that.
Right. And I just I just saw an Instagram post today that like made me lose my mind. And it was, I mean, it was like supposedly a joke, but I'm like, this is not really a joke. And it was like, it was the joke, the quote unquote joke was side effects of the COVID vaccine that would make me consider not taking it, gaining 10 pounds. side effect of the COVID vaccine, to any vaccine that would make me take it no matter what, like, you know, getting rid of crow's feet and tightening my jawline or whatever. So like, yeah, haha, it's supposedly a joke. But also we all know, I mean, the studies will show you people would rather die 10 years early than like gain 20 pounds.
Wow.
Which is insane. It's just completely insane. So, you know, the degree of weight stigma and fat phobia that we are living with in the society has like warped everybody's brains. Well, to such an extent that it's like people don't even recognize it.
I appreciate all of this from multiple directions, the different points you're bringing up with like the food deserts and people's circumstances and not a lot of people in our country and in our world just suddenly being able to pick up and change their diet to whatever they want to and make sure they know exactly what macros they're having in every capacity, which Jen and I think is just bogus and not a measure of your health or your nutrition at all. And like you said, I don't think a lot of people know what real science is in general, but like you said, in this area of food and health is just tough anyway. And for people to want to really dig in and learn it all on that minute level is really tough. So if someone is out there and in a circumstance where they're like stuck and they're like, I really can't change this a ton, and I really don't think at least the weight or the body image thing or the circumstances that I'm in are going to change a ton. Do you have any other tangible tool that someone could be like, you could start this today to kind of...
Yeah, 100%. I think there's two things. One is, this is why having realistic messaging actually empowers people, because when we act like if you just do it perfectly, you'll be a size 2, 5'10" white blonde lady and live forever, which is like kind of what is put out there. People feel so far away from that then it's just easy to be in a black and white, like, fuck it all mentality, right? It's like, there are these structural barriers. I can't ever be that thing. And if that's what's worthy and I'm not, if I'm not, and I know I can't get all the way there, then why would I even try? Whereas I think that if we're more realistic about like, hey, listen, you know, some of your health is going to be impacted by not only your genetics, but like what happened to your grandmother. Right, your epigenetics. Some of it's going to be impacted by where you live. Some of it's going to be impacted by these other things. But yeah, some of it is impacted by you. You do have some. It's like we think that telling people that their power is not absolute is disempowering, but I think it's the opposite, because people aren't idiots and they can tell that they can't completely control some of this stuff. Right. And so being real about it, like, yes, some of it is beyond your control. But some of it you can have an impact on. So let's talk about like what is a small thing that you think you could do that would feel good, right? And so if you are, you know, thinking about health and you want to look at what's actually demonstrated to have some effect on your health, like, it doesn't have to be huge. It's like, can you go for a 10-minute walk? Or if you are not able to walk, if you're not mobile, can you do some seated movement for 10 minutes a day and like move the lymph around in your body, right? Can you like add a vegetable rather than worry about like your macros, or do something really restrictive, like removing all flour and sugar forever? Like, can we look at it from an adding? Can we just add a vegetable at one meal a day? Like, I am a huge fan of like, basically my theory is, if your brain tells you it's too small and doesn't count, that's probably exactly what you should be doing. And do that consistently.
Yeah. I mean, this is everything. It's like, we break it down almost all the time to the basics. Like, are you even sleeping? Are you drinking water? You know, and it's when we actually think of those things.
Your sleep impacts your health a lot more than the exact correct balance of macros.
Exactly.
But nobody can really sell that to you in an image, you know, so it doesn't get as much play. And I think the other part that's really important is just to understand, like, in terms of what, if you can change none of it, let's say you control over none of it, you can't change a single thing about your health or your environment. That's unusual, but okay, let's say that's true. You can still change how you are thinking about yourself and your environment. And that's what's going to make you happy, right? Like, how many, you know, movie stars who get hooked on gambling and are on their 14th divorce do we have to see to understand that, like, being conventionally attractive and wealthy and having a life that looks amazing on Instagram does not create happiness. I have clients come through all the time who have like health conditions that can't be changed, even terminal health conditions that can't be changed. And the way that you think is what's going to determine your experience of your life. And not to mention, actually, that also contributes to your health. Like in the end, if you work on like appreciation, positivity, and self-acceptance, actually that does have positive impacts on your health, because chronic stress from self-criticism and kind of resistance to reality has negative effects on your, you know, hormonal system and endocrine system.
That's one thing I love about just saying positive things out loud or writing them down, or gratitude. I can directly tie that into, or prayer or whatever, singing, to physiologic changes that are happening in my body. And for at least that amount of time, having less stress hormone in me, and some of that has lasting effect throughout days. That's where we go to breath work. You change your nervous system. It has a lasting effect for 24 hours or more. So how can you, no matter the other circumstances, again, control the variables you have control over, the way you think, the way you breathe. I mean, my three things are mindset, movement, and meals. I love to, and mindset, that's a whole third of it. And we can always have control over that, right? So you've given so many amazing tools. Do you have another question?
No, I was just going to say how it's so funny how this relates into the body that we talk about too, because we always say there's people who are telling you this tool, this thing, this external support system, this is going to support you in healing, where it's really, can we build the internal? So we talk about, you know, actually building the strength, actually building the control and the body awareness and all of that to then help fix, you know, these pain issues and stuff. And it's so funny because it's so on the same line as to what you're saying. Rather than focusing on that external stuff that's going to make you happy, you have to focus on this internal aspect, because that's going to be beyond any weight change or things that you have or anything else. And so I just hope people, you know, continue to dive into your work and really want to help themselves and change.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't even get to chronic pain, right? But that is so relevant to all of that stuff. I mean, I let you know, there's the studies show that your experience of post-operational pain is largely predicted by how much you think you're going to be in pain before the surgery, right? Like the way that we think about our physical condition, any pain we have, or whatever, it's more important than the thing itself, right? There's like pain. You might have physical neurological sensations in your body. But then there's all of the suffering that you create with your story about it, your resistance to it, your self-criticism about it. Like all of that part is something you can control.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into that a little bit. I mean, I have some of my own experiences with getting injured. And, you know, as an athlete, again, I talked about how your athleticism is your identity. Your place on the depth chart is your value. And so as soon as you become injured and that immediately starts to change what your identity is, that's tough. And I talked with a lot of athletes as a PT when we're working with them that, you know, the ACL injury, yeah, this is going to physically change the way that you understand your body. But the mental aspect of sitting out seasons of a sport while your team plays or while your team practices and they grow together and they grow their chemistry, and you have this whole thing preventing you from doing what initially fulfilled you, like that's big. So the chronic pain and the cloud and the environment you put around that as far as your mindset is huge. Can you talk into that a little more?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is part of why having this visual culture of like bodies are all supposed to be like thin and able-bodied and like mostly white, although, you know, like sometimes we get a little diversity in the thin, athletic, able-bodied bodies, like from different racial backgrounds, is so damaging, because that's not what most of the world looks like or lives in. And people's bodies are really constructed and function in different ways. And so, I mean, I think that like I still do work on, it's just a really hyper-focused like example of sometimes you can know what's a circumstance, what's a thought, what's a feeling. I find with chronic pain stuff, it's like very complex, and sometimes it's hard to know, like in my own work on it. And, you know, am I having the sensation because there's a structural thing in my body? Am I having the sensation because there used to be a structural thing in my body? My brain now just remembers that. Yep. Is there no structural thing at all? Is it a structural thing somewhere else? That's like refracting here. Like it's, I'm somebody who's like very, very analytical, and I like to be able to put things in categories. And the biggest like thing that I still work on with my thought work on chronic pain is like living in that land of like, okay, I might not know for sure which this is, but how am I going to relate to it anyway? So you know, I think probably, you know, if listeners to this podcast maybe won't be surprised to hear, but there's a high, and you guys know, there's like a high linkage between perfectionistic thinking, black and white thinking, high levels of self-criticism, and chronic pain. And yeah. So it seems like there is some, you know, interesting evidence that people who experience chronic pain, it is a, you know, usually or often a neurologic habit, not a physical problem. And so I think, you know, just that alone is like a challenge to accept at first, and then kind of you have to just work through what's going on. But I think for me, and I know for a lot of my clients, like the first level is always just working on what's your story about the pain and your resistance to the pain and what you make it mean. It's like, I notice that like if I have a little flare of sensation, my brain immediately wants to start telling me about how this just shows that like I'm broken and I'm never going to feel good again. And there's something wrong with me and it shouldn't be this way. And like, shockingly, then I feel terrible, right? Cause of all that story I've made out of it. So I think thought work is such a like important tool, even if you never get to resolving the underlying thing, you're creating so much extra suffering with your story about it that is optional and that you can change.
Oh my, that's so much. We have a whole podcast episode on chronic pain, and we've talked to therapists who've been in the work, you know, for years, and they always come back to diving deeper than what's on the physical biomechanical aspect of pain. And it's so incredibly important. Where is your pain? Just curious.
Well, it moves, mine moves around, which is another good sign that it's like maybe not. So I have hypermobile joints. So there's like a lot of clicking and clacking in my back, you know, like my sacrum is always popping in and out. You can hear it. Like if you practice yoga next to me, you will hear like clickety clack going on. So I get like a lot of subluxation in different joints, particularly in my sacrum, but also in my neck. One of the things that's so fascinating, if you try to start observing the pain instead of identifying with it, is like, it totally changes. Like when it first really manifested, it was very lower back sacral oriented.
Yeah.
And now like a lot of that has resolved. And now, you know, in the last few months, it's been like, oh, the shoulder blade and the rib cage on my right side. Now that's where it's showing up. And I'm someone who's like gotten all the body work, gone to all the physical therapy. even my personal trainer is like an anatomy nerd and really, you know, was trained at the Postural Restoration Institute and is like very dialed into chronic pain in the nervous system. Like I have, you know, worked with all of the experts. And ultimately, I do think it's a, like, for me, you won't get into the whole background, but I think it's like a form of hypervigilance and like having oversensitized to it. And I know this is true in thought work. Like if you, for instance, are someone who believes nobody ever likes me, like there's something wrong with me, like I don't know how to make friends like normal people, like let's say that's your thought pattern, you will constantly be finding evidence of that, and your brain is constantly scanning for it. And I think that that happens with chronic pain too. Like if you have told yourself that a certain kind of sensation or a sensation in a certain location is a problem and means something is wrong, then your brain is just constantly hypervigilant and looking for more and more little, like smaller and smaller signals or like, you know, movements that it can sort of amplify and tell you there's a problem. So a lot of my work on it so far has really been like taking it down a notch, just sort of being like, okay, brain, I hear you, but that's not actually an emergency. Everything's okay. You are not actually hurt. Like, this is just a sensation. You don't need to inform me every time you notice like a tiny muscle twitch. Like, I don't need all this information. Like having a real dialogue with my brain about it.
Yes.
And I'm so glad that you kind of talked through all of that, because as a PT trying to educate people about creating this relationship with their chronic pain and what's actually happening in your nervous system, and it's like, yeah, you may have been injured at one point, but then your brain just learned to be super, super hypervigilant. So now when a breeze rolls by, it puts our nervous system into this fight or flight state really easily. And it becomes this systemic thing and these systemic patterns we start developing. And like you said, with the memory and like, oh, that space or that spot, when I start feeling this thing triggers this, our brain just inertly ingrains those patterns. And it makes it so much tougher to get out of that, like you said, unless we just start to train it slightly differently. So I appreciate you kind of diving into that just a little bit more, because we preach this message all the time And we try to do so consciously about how the image, you know, what we see on the image doesn't equal the pain. Because like you said, we may have injured something at one point and that probably hurt. But we also take images of hundreds of people that don't have any pain at all and find tons of stuff on their images.
Yeah, and you hear that about like autopsies too. It's like person had like 6 herniated discs and they didn't feel a thing.
Yeah, like, oh my gosh, this person's brain shows they should have had rampant like dementia and stuff, but they were pretty good until, they died or whatever. So you see these things that is like, oh, our body is showing images and whatever that we should be manifesting this pain, but who has told us forever that we should be feeling pain just because it looks like that? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where the message comes in. So many valuable tools that you have shared. I'm glad we got to tack in that little chronic pain talk on the end. Where can people find more about you? We know you have the podcast, you're on different social media platforms. Where can people dig into the stuff that you put out?
Yeah, I think just come, find the podcast. If any of this resonated with you, it's called Unfuck Your Brain. It's anywhere you get your podcast, it'll be there, or unfuckyourbrain.com. And that's the easiest, because trying to remember how to spell my last name to find me on Instagram, I would start with go to the website and there's a link there.
Yeah. Amazing. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This was such a great conversation and we went a little long. So hopefully everyone stuck in with us, but we just appreciate the work that you're doing, how open you're being about your journey. Like even to say, this is what I'm still struggling with it just means a lot to Dom and I, because we really appreciate the vulnerability and, the strength that you have in being able to continue to walk this journey and share it with people. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And there we have it, yet another amazing guest on the Optimal Body Podcast. So now what we ask of you, if you loved any bit of that or resonated with it, go share it out, share it with a friend, share it on your social media, because you know there are more people out there that would resonate with it just the same. Also, subscribe, rate, review on your favorite podcast app so we know what you want to learn or other guests that you think we should bring on for you in the future. Keep tuning in to find your optimal body.